This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
HBCUs provided this pathway
Absolutely.
For highly successful Black people because they were shut out of these other institutions.
This is not a blue state. Every election is close.
From WDET in Detroit, this is Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm here with the show's producer, Cary Jr. II.
I always wonder if it's a mouthful to have to say it's full Cary Jr. and the second every single time.
One day we're going to do a show about your name.
why is it Jr. and the second?
That's right.
Good to be here, Steve. Another good week of episodes.
Yeah, great week of episodes.
Yeah.
And as we get further into doing Created Equal and creating the space for the show,
right.
I think we find ourselves exploring lots of different kinds of themes about equality and
right.
and how they kind of play out in American life. This week, of course, we had an election,
right.
which took up a lot of space
took
in
up a lot of
the news cycle and took up some space on the show. We talked about why, for instance, Michigan was voting so early this year
mm-hmm.
because for years and years, we've gone kind of in the middle of the pack after a lot of the decisions have been made. They've been working for a long time to make sure that a state that's as diverse and key as Michigan has a bigger voice.
Yeah, it was good to have Debbie Dingell on to talk about the strategy behind that and how long they had been trying to make this push to get the state to be moved up earlier.
Yep.
We also found out eventually had the impact of what that might mean
right?
for this presidential election
right.
very quickly. So to have that
never kind of, a dull election in it, Michigan is what
exactly.
I say.
What did you say? We're a purple state now. You
we
know?
Are a purple state.
So
yeah. we're also know. Just kind of a unpredictable state.
Unpredictable.
You just don't
state.
Know what's going to happen when you show up here. We also yeah. talked about voting rights and the way in which the founders thought about voting rights, but also how they didn't think about them. This was a conversation from 2021 when we were talking a lot about the Constitution on Detroit Today. And we had a conversation about why there is no explicit right to vote mentioned in the Constitution. There are lots of restrictions in the Constitution that would apply to the right to vote that you can't prevent people from voting for certain reasons. But there isn't this kind of affirmative, hey, everyone has the same right to cast a ballot in our Constitution. We talked with two constitutional experts about why that was true and, what does it mean today, even as we continue to struggle with who is included in the franchise.
I mean, for me, it's the fact that this is a conversation that you've had already kind of similarly on the show about the Constitution and voting rights and its ambiguity. But it's also a conversation you've had some years ago that still applies to today, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is something that is constantly going to be under discussion, trying to understand our laws, what it means, what it governs, and how our current circumstances play into that. A lot has changed since the Constitution was written.
Absolutely.
And how does that play into our day-to-day lives? So another great conversation.
And then we had a conversation that I will call Cary's conversation Cary's this week.
Conversation.
It was about historically Black colleges and universities. Aisha Roscoe of NPR, she is a weekend host here, has written a book called HBCU Made, and it is a collection of essays about experiences at HBCUs. Cary, you could have written part of the book.
I could have. You're right. I could have been one of the essayists. You're right, because I entered an HBCU. Yeah, I was happy to have Aisha Roscoe just to have her talk about what that experience means. And one thing that she says is really impactful that I hadn't thought about was how HBCUs have an impact on its graduates, but how that impact goes beyond because of what graduates are doing
yes.
and how that's important for us to have those institutions. And then her journey into her field as well. So.
Yeah. No, I mean, one of the key parts of that conversation was about how the doubts about HBCUs kind of get answered, I think, in this book. I mean, I started out asking her, is that what she thinks of the book as being, an answer to those things? And she has such a great answer. She's like, it technically is, but more than that, it's an affirmative embrace and celebration of the idea of HBCUs and their importance to not just people who go to them and graduate, but to the African-American community at large. It was one of my favorite answers from the week.
A testimony is what she liked to say.
That's right, a testimony.
Southern church girl.
That's exactly right.
I will say, Stephen, the words doubts, like, we don't have doubts. Us graduates, man. Well, the ones that were raised in HBCU families.
Right.
There were no doubts.
I was talking about external doubts, right? Lots of people who are, I think, saying, well, it's 2024. Why do we need colleges that focus on African Americans? I hear that from time to time. And I thought this book really laid all of that to waste, all of those questions. So it was a really great conversation. But we are going to start with the conversation with Debbie Dingell about Michigan's new status as an early primary state.
This is a complicated subject because I first want to say that every vote matters. So every person matters. But those two, New Hampshire and Iowa, do not reflect the population of this country. And what you want to do in a primary or caucus system is talk about the issues. They're going to be the issues. They're going to be the ones that matter in the general election. So what I, and by the way, I don't think any one state should have a lock on going first. I think everybody's got the right to have candidates talk about their issues, to take the time to spend, to understand their issues, to have the national media focus on it. So I think that if we really have managed to shake this process up, and discussions continue to how to make it fairer and more representative, maybe you down the road go to regional primaries so the candidates are in regions that may have similar issues, but that, you know, you're really talking about what the issues are. The reason that I have fought for Michigan to be one of the early states with others is that, one, Michigan is a purple state. Someday, everybody's going to believe me that Michigan's not a blue state. It's not red. Most people don't argue too much it's red, but this is not a blue state. Every election is close. We reflect the diversity of the country, but we make things and we grow things. We have, as you just said, we have a significant urban African-American population, Hispanic population, but we have significant... We've got farming communities. We've got union communities. We have Arab American communities, Muslim communities, Indian communities. I'm now going to get in trouble because we have women and men. And there are a lot of communities that are really important. We have a lot of people of faith, but those faiths are all different religions. We have Baptists and Catholics and Christians and Hindus and atheists, and I'm not leaving anybody out here. I just don't want to. That's what's so good. But, you know, when people talk about New Hampshire or Iowa, they say, well, they get hands on. They get to talk to voters directly. You know what? You can talk to voters directly here. We have a richness of festivals and farmers markets and places where people come together and talk about the issues that are just on their minds on any given Saturday. I'm at 14 different events, and that's one of the reasons I have good gut, and will tell you who I and what. You didn't think I was correct at the time, but I told you that Donald Trump was going to win Michigan because I go in those union halls. I'm at those in farmers markets. I don't know who's going to win. I think Michigan's a competitive state right now, just for the record. But you can talk to people. And we have all four seasons. We understand all the issues that come with seasons. We have 20% of the world's fresh water. There is all the issues, not all, because we have a border, but it doesn't have the same border issues that the South does. We should have states in there that are talking about the border issue because that matters so much. You need to make sure that those states that are having such a strong impact on who gets nominated are states where the issues that are going to matter in November are being talked about. People are expressing their opinion and they're voting how they feel, and what they're voting is going to determine who that candidate's going to be in November.
Yeah. And of course, if we look back at history here in Michigan, both on the Democratic and the Republican side, we've had a tendency to surprise a little bit, to do things that that national pundits or media might not predict, and to do things that don't necessarily follow the trend of the primaries that come before us. Okay, so I'm going to go back to 1988, of course, when Jesse Jackson was a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. He won the state of Michigan. It was one of the only states that he did win. I'm not sure if it was the only one, but it was certainly one of the only ones. And it was on the strength of the diversity of the party here in Michigan that he was able
to do
that.
George Wallace also.
George Wallace won the primary
also,
back
because
in 68,
I think
right?
It's very important that when we have these discussions that we want to make sure everybody's included. Mm-hmm. So sometimes one of the things that's happening in this state is that a union worker doesn't feel like they matter. They do matter. Every person matters. We want the African-American voter in the city of Detroit or the city of Pontiac or Ypsilanti or Oakland County, they need to be heard. Mm-hmm. Their issues matter. But so does that union worker. I'll tell you right now, we got to get in every union hall in this state right now because union voters are worried about their future, what's going to happen to their job. You know, we say we're bringing them home. Are we really bringing them home? We need to worry about urban issues. We've had a great year. We're seeing, I mean, everybody knows Detroit's got grit, but there's still a lot of urban issues that are facing not only us in Michigan, but a lot of cities around the country.
Around the country, yeah.
There, you know, we've got low unemployment numbers now, but there's an anxiety. Too many people can't afford to get an education. Do you need a college education now? How do we begin to talk about technical training? And quite frankly, there, you know, we need a lot more plumbers and electricians than we do lawyers. So all of these kinds of issues Michigan talks about. You talk about agriculture, talk about food. How do you get workers for the farmers and the small businesses? And Michigan has all of those issues. And every issue that somebody cares about, people should be able to talk to somebody who might be president of the United States.
Yeah. I also want to go specifically back to 2016, which you brought up earlier, and talk about specifically what happened here. So in the primary, and to refresh the listeners' memory, the two major candidates in the Democratic primary that year were Hillary Clinton, who was a senator from New York, and Bernie Sanders, who's a senator from Vermont. And it was a pretty close contest for some time. Bernie Sanders won the primary here in Michigan. He didn't win overwhelmingly. It was pretty close, but he did get more delegates than Clinton did. And at the time, I think the part of the narrative was about the kind of problem that Hillary Clinton was having connecting with certain populations here in the state of Michigan. Fast forward to that October, to that November, when she is the nominee facing Donald Trump, and you were telling me about those problems that she was having connecting. You were seeing it in the district that that you live in, or that you were living in at that point. And it had a lot to do, in fact, with voters who are of Arab descent who live here in Michigan. We have the largest population of those Americans in the country. And it strikes me that in retrospect, if that had been evident earlier in the primary process, in other words, if Michigan had had a more prominent spot on the calendar in 2016, again, these issues might have been debated more hotly. They might have been more publicly thought of. And it's a great example of what you're talking about, that if you don't do it early enough, if you don't include everybody early enough, you really don't know what's going on.
There were so many issues that were, I started to tell you in 2015 that Hillary Clinton had a problem. Nobody believed me, but she's my friend.
A specific problem in Michigan, right.
And the reason, quite frankly, that I heard it, I mean, I did begin to hear it in Dearborn. Bernie did very well in Dearborn. But I want to go to 215 when I remember the picnic. It was Local 900's annual picnic. And I know those guys and women well. And some of those guys walked up to me. And I picked a candidate, wasn't doing anything. And said to me, Debbie, we love you, but we don't love your girl. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And they told me there was no way they're going to be able to vote for her a year early. And it was because of trade. And I kept telling the Democratic Party that our workers had seen their jobs shipped overseas. They were tired of seeing them shipped overseas, and nobody cared. And it's when we began, and Donald Trump understood it. He understood that fear and that anxiety of the working people.
Said
by the way,
repeal NAFTA,
didn't do a lot, but he understood and came in here months later, months, and said, I'm going to repeal NAFTA. I'm not going to let your jobs be sent overseas. And when I'm intense, I was intense screaming at people, and people didn't hear me. People didn't go into union halls. I live in union halls. I make sure, COVID changed it a little, but now that we're getting back, I want to be in those union halls. I want to see everybody. And those union halls, by the way, reflect the diversity of this state. Sure. You see people of all different backgrounds, men and women, and people of all different cultural and ethnic backgrounds, and they tell me the truth.
Yeah.
And if you want to know the truth, you keep your mouth shut and you listen to what people are saying to you.
Yeah. Coming up, Aisha Rasko's new book, HBCU Made. We'll be right back with more Created Equal.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson. Our guest today is Aisha Rasko. She's a former White House correspondent, a graduate of Howard University, and author of a book titled HBCU Made, A Celebration of the Black College Experience. Aisha, I want to talk about the book and how you decided to write it and how you decided to include these stories from other people in it. How did you pick them? And what were you thinking about when you put together this roster of other storytellers?
Algonquin, the publisher of the book, came to me with this idea, and they said, would you want to put together a collection of essays about HBCUs, and have HBCU graduates, in their own words, talk about their experience mm-hmm. and why it mattered so much to them. And the thing that they said to me that really stood out was that this hadn't been done before. And that was a shocker to me, because this seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And then, I couldn't believe that this had not been done. I thought about it a little bit, but I couldn't let it go, and I decided to become the author and the editor of this, and to go out and ask all these people to write essays and to beg and plead and to get them, which is a lot. It's a lot to ask busy and successful people to write 3,000 words
yeah.
about their experience. But what I was looking for was people, both known and unknown, who could talk about how the HBCU experience, how it was unique, and how it set them on a path, and what that meant to them. And I felt like, it was really important to me to get a wide range of contributors. So, from people who are a little more seasoned to people who are, just starting out, Brandon Gilpin, an actor. He's the youngest person in the book. He just graduated from Morehouse in 2021. Mm. So I wanted, different generations. And then it was also very, very important to me that I get, you know, a wide range of institutions represented, because there are 100 HBCUs in the country, in the U.S. And so, you know, it's not just the Howards and the Morehouses. You know, there are a lot of HBCUs that get less attention. A lot of them are smaller. And so I wanted to get, you know, the Talladegas and the, you know, the Morgan States and Dillard's. So I wanted them to be represented as well. So so that was also a part of, you know, the what I was looking for and seeking in these essays.
Yeah. The book also includes lots of information that puts HBCUs in the kind of context of inequality and challenges that we have with higher ed in the country, and of course with race. Why was it important for you to include things like discussion of the lack of support for LGBTQ students, for instance, or the financial struggles that we still see at lots of HBCUs?
Well, I think going back to, like, as a reporter, like, for me, I never wanted this book to just be PR or to be fluff. I always knew that it would include things that might not put HBCUs in the best light, because I feel like, and you know, when I was pitching this to people, I would say, you know, I do look at this as a love letter, but love is complicated. And love is not, you know, love is challenging. And sometimes loving something means challenging it to be the best that it can possibly be. And so it was important to me to have, you know, Michael Arsenault, who is a New York Times bestselling author, has a new book coming out in March. So make sure you get it. you know, I wanted to, you know, it was important to me to have his essay as a gay Black man who wasn't out at Howard and eventually did come out, but wasn't out when he first started at Howard, and talking about his experience and to talk about how, you know, there were attacks on gay students at, you know, Howard and other HBCUs, and how that affected him. And, you know, how there was still a lot of room to grow in having universities accept and love and embrace these Black people who are also who are Black people, but also have these other identities. Right. And to he basically said that he wanted Howard to love him as much as he loved it. And I think that that was important. I think that was really important to have and to talk about in this book.
Do you see through lines in the essays, other than, of course, this reverence and love for the institutions where, you know, people attended school? Are there other things that kind of bind the essays together in your mind?
Well, there's a lot of, you know, I always say there's community. You know, you see throughout the essays where people really talk about how not only did they develop their own communities there, but that they, you know, you have these professors and other people who really poured into, you know, the contributors, and they talk about how, what that meant to them. Tendai Kumba at Spelman, a Broadway dancer and singer, who got into a bad accident at Spelman and didn't know if she was going to dance again, and her Spelman community really rallied around her. And now she's, you know, on Broadway, and so I think that so that sort of community, another, you know, the talking about diversity, also a lot of just the fun, like there's a lot of fun at, HBCUs. Another thing that's come up, and I think, is, you know, people are even talking about now, is A Different World. I mean, that show, and they're having a reunion now, and they're going to HBCUs in Atlanta and talking about the importance of HBCUs. But like in this book, so many of the essays talked about the impact of a different world, yeah. and how they, you know, how that just made them want to go to an HBCU, and how that, you know, how that encouraged them and all this stuff. And so, you know, to the point where at some of the essays, I just couldn't even include it because I said, at this point, we've had it enough. But I just think that when you look at it now, like I said, they're doing a reunion. I mean, it's just incredible how much that piece of pop culture, like, really had an impact on people.
Yeah.
And continues to have an impact to this day. But I also think that it speaks to how the HBCU experience and the culture of the HBCU experience is so dynamic and could touch people back then and touch people to today.
Yeah. I mean, thinking about A Different World, which premiered when I was, I think, 11 or 12, and the impact that it's had on HBCUs. Well, you know, one of the things that was really great about that show, I thought, was that, you know, I mean, it grows out of The Cosby Show. And, you know, that's an upper middle class family with two, you know, highly professional parents and all kinds of resources and success and things. And, you know, I do remember friends of mine, white friends of mine, saying when that show, when A Different World started, that they were kind of surprised at the emphasis on an HBCU by a family like the family that was depicted, you know, on The Cosby Show. And I was like, well, you know, lots of people, lots of people go to HBCUs. It's not for one type of black family. The history is all across African American life. And I don't think people really, I do think there were a lot of people who didn't know that before that show. Yeah.
And didn't know, I mean, and I think that show really depicts how not only that, but that HBCUs provided this pathway
Absolutely.
For highly successful black people because they were shut out of these other institutions. And so they would go to HBCUs and then become very famous. And that's why Whitley Gilbert's family named the dorm
that's
and all
right.
that. Like, because you would have these, you know, and that there were these legacies. So you had these very upper crust, you know, black people, and you still see this today, you know, people who, you know, some are at Martha's Vineyard and are who have, you know, very long histories of going to HBCUs because HBCUs provided education to that very high level of, you know, black people and black achievement. But then you also had, and depicted on that show, the people who were kind of just getting in,
just
first
getting by.
In their generation yeah. mm-hmm. to go. You know, maybe their grades weren't that great. Family doesn't have money like that. So you saw the range of it, like that not everybody came. So, yeah, you had the kind of rich upper class, like the Whitley Gilberts, but then you had the more working class, yeah. like Kimberly Reese
right.
and all of that, you know, right. like, so you had like the, and then, you know, later on, of course, you would have Jada Pinkett's Smith's character,
sure.
who was just like getting in by the seat of her teeth, right? Like, I mean, I just think that you, but I think that is really true to the HBCU experience, where you have many, many students who are there who are first generation. You have many students there that are Pell Grant recipients. But you do also have these legacy
yeah.
students, these students who come from generations of people, of black people who have gone to these HBCUs and are very proud, you know, graduates of these HBCUs that accepted them and embraced them when these other schools would not.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk about after college for you in particular, and what it's meant to be a Howard graduate, both in positive ways and maybe in some challenging ways. What do people think of where you went to school and in the world where you operate now in journalism and in Washington? What's the way that that Howard kind of plays a role, I guess, in your life now?
Well, you know, I got my very first job at Reuters, and this was a job that I was at for a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So really set the foundation for my journalism career because of Howard. They had a business reporting class where they partnered with Reuters, and I was in the class, and that's how, you know, people at Reuters became familiar with my work. I will say that it kind of depends on the time period. The time period when I was coming out, say for instance, a lot of the internship programs, especially for kind of like, you know, the Reuters and the Bloombergs and the big ones, they generally would have students from all the Ivy Leagues, from Harvard, Columbia grad school, you know, Yale, you know, maybe mm-hmm. Mizzou.
Yeah.
Maybe they do a state school like Mizzou, which is known for, you know, journalism and things like that. But not necessarily Howard. I think that has changed now. Mm. I think because there's a push for diversity. So a lot of institutions will have, you know, maybe special partnerships with HBCUs. So I think it kind of ebbs and flows. But at that time, there were not like a lot of people from Howard who were in the internship program. I was the only one.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about what year that is, though. I mean,
that was 2007.
Yeah. So this, we're not talking about 30, 40 years ago. We're talking just a decade and a half ago had these barriers for people from places like Howard.
Yeah, you know, and I think after they got me, they did get another, my good friend, who became my good friend, they did get some more Howard people.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's part of the, so I think that, you know, when you look at the challenges, I think there are times when if you're not going to these certain schools,
right,
these certain Ivy Leagues, you may not be at the front of the line. But I will say, like I said, I think that in many ways, with the emphasis on diversity and the emphasis on trying to reach out, you do have a lot of companies now that go to HBCU specifically
looking for talent,
to look for people. But all of that can be based on kind of ebbs and flows. But I will say that going to Howard, you know, like it was the best decision for me. And it really, like I said, it's how I got my first job. And really, in reality, like, you know, when I tell people I went to Howard, people are always like, oh, wow. Like, I mean, I think that there is like an acknowledgement of it. And there's a respect for it. I do believe that. And I do think there's a camaraderie, too, among other people who went to HBCUs. And it doesn't have to be your HBCU, right? Like, I think that people, like, there is a community and a connection for HBCU graduates, whether they went to, you know, whether they went to the same HBCU or not. So April Ryan, who's in the book and is a legendary, you know, White House correspondent, she went to Morgan State and is a good friend of mine. So I think that it's, you know, I think that you can have a camaraderie, you know, even just among HBCU grads.
That was Aisha Rasko talking with me about her new book, HBCU Made. Coming up next, the Founding Fathers didn't include the right to vote explicitly in the U.S. Constitution. Why not? And what impact has that had on ballot access ever since? That's coming up next on Created Equal.
In 2021, WDET hosted a book club that was focused on the Constitution. I had a conversation about voting rights, specifically the fact that they were not enshrined explicitly in the Constitution. I spoke with two experts to talk about it. Bertrall Ross is a professor of law at the University of Virginia and a constitutional law expert who focuses on election law and voting rights. Ted Johnson is a senior advisor at New America and is a contributing columnist for The Washington Post. Here's our conversation.
Okay, before we get to listeners, I want to talk a little about the history of voting rights and gender and equality. Bertrall Ross, women are not protected explicitly in the Constitution as it's adopted initially, and it takes a long time to get to the point where they are. The 19th Amendment, of course, prevents people from being denied the right to vote on the basis of gender. But what's interesting when you compare, I guess, that journey to the journey on race is once that amendment is passed and adopted, that pretty much ends much of the debate about gender. And we don't have that debate today. There isn't a real effort in America by anyone really to deny that. And so that's a real contrast, I guess, to the narrative on race, which continues to haunt us in real ways in 2021.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that the closer proximity between women and men, in terms of women often being in the same household as men, can change the dynamics in terms of the voting rights discussion. In terms of prior to the 19th Amendment, the sense that men had were that these Victorian sensibilities, these sexist notions of the place of the woman in the home, and out of politics, because politics was just too, you know, dirty or just not fit for women. Those notions kind of carried some weight. There's some weight notes associated with the idea that women were dependent on men, and so men would represent them through a form of virtual representation in politics. But once we get to the female empowerment movements that start to emerge in the middle of the 19th century and have carried forward through different sort of waves of feminist movements, even to the present, those ideas get rejected. And to the extent that when the 19th Amendment's passed, this idea that women are dependent, that women don't belong in politics has been relegated to the sense that it's old-fashioned, it's outdated, and that we need women to be an active part of our polity. Now, there's still a struggle, though, ongoing, and that struggle is perhaps less visible and less noticed, and it has to do with female office holding. Hmm. Despite the fact that women make up half the population, they make up a much smaller proportion of office holders in the United States. In Congress, they've made up around 25% to 30% over the last decade, which has been a high, whereas, again, that's a much smaller proportion of the population that they make up. And I think that that fact is based on differential opportunities to run for office and also differential networks in terms of campaign finance and funding opportunities, but also in terms of people's attitudes, in terms of who are the ideal leaders. How do people understand either implicitly or explicitly what leaders are supposed to look like? And that has a gender orientation to it. And that, as a result, has had an effect on female office holding that continues to this day. It's a struggle that we continue to try to overcome.
Mm-hmm. And there's also kind of an overlap of the narratives about racial equality in voting and gender equality in voting, in the sense that a lot of the activists who pushed for the passage of the 19th Amendment were, of course, African-American women who, like other women, wanted to see that barrier fall. And even though the 19th Amendment was adopted, those women, because they were African-American, were still denied the right to vote until the passage of the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s. And in that way, there's this kind of bitter irony, I guess, to the 19th.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that one of the things to account for is that just like they are today, women, black women, are the backbones, the foundation of the African-American community. And so when we saw the struggle for the 15th Amendment, there was a strong push and call for African-American women to attach female voting rights for women, and a voting rights amendment for women to that 15th Amendment. But ultimately, there was a decision made, negotiations made to exclude women from that project of voting rights. And so the struggle continued for the next 50 years. And there's quite a bit of tension between these suffrage movements, women's suffrage movements, and sort of this idea that African-American men should govern and should take an important role in terms of representing African-American women. And so what we see in terms of emerging at the time of the Voting Rights Act is this emergence of black women as being an important political force from the 1960s to the present. And so Stacey Abrams, that you had a recording of earlier, she is an example of black women empowerment that has been central to the expression of voice of the African-American communities. Because the fact is, there are many laws in place that have disfranchised disproportionately African-American men. And I'm speaking of laws that disfranchise persons with felony convictions, even after they have completed their terms in prison. And because we know that there is this racial orientation to the criminal justice system, African-American men have been denied voices in ways that are particularly harmful to the African-American community, and women have had to step in to fill that political void.
Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. Call and tell us what you think about the state of voting rights in America. Let's go to Ed in Detroit. Ed, what's on your mind?
Timely conversation.
Thank you.
To steal a line from a deceased politician, can only say the struggle endures. I've thought in recent years a lot about how we run elections and how our peer countries, two dozen to 30 or so mature, wealthy democracies. And in the U.S., elections seem to be confounded by race and over-reliance on political actors. Obviously, your guests have talked about the role of race, but in most of our peer countries, the question of where electoral district boundaries will be and who gets the right to vote are purely technical questions administered by either non-partisan commissions or civil servants. Mm-hmm. If you meet the minimal standards to vote, you're eligible to vote. And in this country, we've let political actors manage this process. And as your guests have correctly pointed out, political actors will attempt to jimmy the system for their benefit, whether it's Democrats in Maryland or Republicans in North Carolina. And we need to follow the lead of our peer countries and take this role away from politicians so that obviously get race out of it, because mm-hmm. it's not only hurt black people, but in our history, it's also hurt First Nation people and Hispanic and Asian immigrants sure. to the U.S.
Yeah.
at various times and in various places
yeah.
have been adversely affected by the unwillingness of white people, to be frank, to let non-white people vote.
Right.
I'll listen to your guests on the phone.
Ed,
on the
radio. I really appreciate the call and the provocative thoughts there. Ted Johnson, I think you were talking earlier about this idea of the ways in which politicians see voting rights as connected to their own fortunes in office. But I think Ed's even going further and saying that, look, if you take away the power that politicians have essentially to choose their voters, right, rather than having voters choose them, that you get closer to some ideal of equality. And here in Michigan, we're actually embarking on that very experiment. In 2018, voters here decided to hand the process of dividing up voters into districts to a nonpartisan commission, or I should say a bipartisan commission, and take it away from politicians. That does connect, I think, to the arguments and the discussions about equality.
Yeah, it does. So just a couple quick notes. The first is when it comes to liberal democracies around the world, we are the longest living constitutional democracy and one of the largest democracies, period. One of the most diverse, and certainly have a unique history relative to other large diverse democracies that exist out there. So part of that history is that we delegate the carrying out of elections to the states, which is to say there are more than 50 sets of rules for how elections are conducted, how voters must register, residency requirements, all these sorts of things in one nation here in the United States. Because if you move from Virginia to North Carolina, there's a whole set of administrative actions you have to take to legally participate in North Carolina's election, even though you were eligible to participate while a resident of Virginia, for example. So that is one thing that makes us distinct, that your geographical location changes how you can access the right to vote, and that there are more than 50 sets of rules here. So that's a problem. Some folks have suggested things like making Election Day a federal holiday will incentivize people to go vote, or sort of these redistricting commissions. These are all good ideas, but it doesn't change the fact that there is no one single set of rules for this right we call fundamental to participate in elections in the United States. And so even if we tinker with the systems, we may make elections more fair at the local and state levels, but the national right to vote, to participate in elections, will be left unaddressed. One last quick point on this. Many states have the right to vote in their state constitutions. Mm-hmm. So while it's not in the federal constitution, that right to vote is extended to some extent by the states. So you get the post-Civil War right amendment. So it's not like politicians and parties can just run roughshod over the right, but they have become very, very crafty in figuring out the loopholes so that they can construct an electorate that is more advantageous to them than the other party they're running against. Mm-hmm.
That was a conversation I had with Bertrall Ross and Theodore Johnson from the 2021 WDET Book Club about the Constitution.
Yeah, that was an interesting conversation indeed, Stephen.
Yeah. I mean, that whole summer, what we did was take different parts of the Constitution, look at them really closely, and try to explain why some of the things that we were dealing with in 2021 were happening, and how they found their roots in that original document. It was a really interesting summer. We had a lot of very wide ranging conversations, but this one about voting rights is one of my favorites.
Did you have any call-ins or feedback shows that day? Those days
we did have call-ins, it was interesting to see how many people wanted to talk about the Constitution at that point. Because if you remember what was happening in 2021, this was kind of the hangover period from the Trump administration, and the Biden administration was trying to find its footing to, I think, really set things back on a normalcy scale. And we were talking about what it means to be an American, what things we expect to happen or not happen in our country. And the Constitution is a really wonderful guide for thinking about those questions, even today.
Yeah, the protests at the Capitol were also there too. So.
That's right. And then in January of that year.
Yeah, there's a lot of context that sets up the urgency of that. So still relevant today.
Yes, all still relevant today. Yeah. And of course, talking about the election, which we did last week, and HBCU's really good week here on Created Equal. And we got another great week coming in just a few days.
Sure do.
Yeah. My moment of the week was on Thursday's show when we were talking about the Tuesday primary election. And we had two guests from the Arab American community, both who told these really personal stories about their journey to America and their escape from violence. I think that issue of equality doesn't get highlighted enough. Freedom from constant fear of violence.
On to the next week.
On to the next week.
And listen to these episodes on the podcast individually if you want to get a little bit more.
The ones that we didn't wrap up in the wrap-up show.
That'll do it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes online at WDET.org. And of course, make sure to subscribe to our podcast. Created Equal is produced by Carey Jr. II and David Lines. Our sound editing is by Connor Anderson. And our music is by Sam Bobian. Our digital team is Jenny Sherman, Dave Kim, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, Detroit's public radio.